A photographer's anger today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. National Geographic's Joel Sartori is on a mission to photograph Earth's rapidly vanishing animal species.
People ask me all the time if I get depressed. I don't get depressed. I get mad, and I get inspired to want to use their stories and really get the world to try to pay attention.
Also, Trump says it's Made in America Week. We look at how one Iowa town survived after 2,000 local jobs were sent to Mexico and elsewhere.
You know, when you lose that many people out of a community, companies say, wow, I'm going to come to Newton, Iowa, because they got the infrastructure, they got the buildings, and they got the workforce.
Plus, who stole the cheddar? Make that two giant blocks of cheddar.
Each one weighs about the same as a large bag of cement.
That's all ahead today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World on a Tuesday. Good to have you along with us. The last 24 hours for Donald Trump have been like walking down the up escalator. No joy on repealing the Affordable Care Act that Trump promised to take down during and after his campaign. And now it seems his own cabinet has succeeded in convincing him not to scrap the Iran nuclear deal, the one Trump's repeatedly called the worst ever. That's what we want to dig into right here at the top of the show. For the second time since taking office, Trump has agreed to certify that Iran is complying with the International Nuclear Accord. The agreement requires the White House to make that determination every 90 days, but President Trump also reportedly told his national security team that he won't continue to stand by it indefinitely. So the agreement with Iran lives on, but for how long? Benim Ben Taleblou is a senior Iran analyst at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies in Washington. He appreciates Trump's cynicism about the deal.
This Friday, the body that oversees the nuclear deal will be meeting in Vienna. And if the administration went into those talks and went into those discussions without having upped the ante on the rest of the threats that Iran poses, and particularly its violations of the spirit of the accord, I think it would have been playing into Tehran's hands here. So this is probably a calculated and more measured approach that we're seeing from the administration, which I would say is a plus. And it's also worth noting that there is an interagency Iran policy review going on. And until that review is concluded, I think the administration should arm itself with as much data as possible and take as much time as it needs to make sure that nothing happens with the deal that isn't actually planned.
What are those threats that Iran poses right now?
Well, some of the key sectors that the administration has targeted in the new sanctions, the batch of 18 designations that came out this morning, are Iran's ballistic missiles. In particular, we know that Iranian entities have been doing some hacking, as revealed by the Justice Department yesterday, into ballistic missile trajectories in software that actually tracks those missiles, particularly for the systems that the U.S. has deployed in the Persian Gulf or could deploy in the Persian Gulf. There's the actual entities that procure and produce missiles inside Iran and outside of the country. And of course, there's the IRGC, Aerospace Force, which are the guardians of the Iranian ballistic missile force.
So just remind us how the nuclear deal works, briefly.
So the nuclear deal is a phased approach. It's not a treaty. It's a multilateral arms control agreement where Iran curbs some of its sensitive stockpiles like heavy water and LEU for a time period and receives major EU and Asian sanctions relief, permitting those countries to send their businesses back into the Iranian market, and U.S. nuclear sanctions relief. The U.S. still continues to have terrorism, select missile, and human rights sanctions on the books. But this deal is basically a phased approach where in 10 years' time, or basically now in 8 years' time, Tehran will be permitted to have an industrial-scale civil nuclear capability. The question is this trade-off, sanctions for centrifuges, worth it come that 10 years?
Given that the White House has been so critical of the agreement, you know, Trump has called it the worst deal ever, why do you think they have not abandoned it?
Absent a larger strategy, they wouldn't want to do more damage. And this seems to be something like the Hippocratic Oath here, first, do no harm. That doesn't mean that they'll permit this to be a new normal. And I think the 18 designations and sanctions this morning clearly communicate that. So I disagree again with Foreign Minister Zarif, who said the U.S. is sending mixed signals here. The signal, in my view, has been until the interagency deal review is done, the U.S. will continue to do what my colleague here at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, Mark Dubowitz, has called a wave and slap strategy, where they wave sanctions and slap on new ones.
Got it. So when it comes to complying with the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, do you trust Iran?
Unfortunately, no. I don't trust Iran, and I'm a little bit disheartened at the International Atomic Energy Agency right now. And in fact, the UN Security Council, the new resolution 2231, which turns 2 years old this Thursday. And that's because with this new deal and the UN resolution enshrining it, The panel of experts, which really is an expert body that used to oversee previous sanctions resolutions, such as 1929, which had stringent measures on Iran. That resolution was terminated, replaced by the new one, and there was no panel of experts replicated for the new deal. So how we know Iran is complying with the deal, or how we know Iran is allegedly implementing everything in the deal, we know that through the Secretary General reports, which come out every 6 months. And these just kind of rehash the macro-level claims. IAEA reporting has been a little bit less quantitative than I would have liked, and again, many nuclear scholars would have liked. So it's hard to see. This deal was sold on transparency, and it's been much less transparent than promised. So I'm a little disheartened by that.
The West once had this kind of deal with North Korea, and now North Korea is a major nuclear threat. What is the lesson from that experience?
I think there are several key lessons with that experience, and the first is negotiating with rogue regimes. When you do that, kicking the can down the line may not be enough. And the second is an assumption which I think is flawed, but we replicate it with the Iranians here, which is that you can excise the nuclear issue from the larger threats that that state poses. We've done that here, and it doesn't seem to be working. Iran has actually stepped up the nature of its threats that it poses to the region. And similarly, North Korea, you know, its nuclear program notwithstanding, it also poses a major conventional threat to U.S. allies in Northeast Asia.
Benim Ben Taliblu is a senior Iran analyst at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies in Washington. Another huge source of tension between the U.S. and Iran is Tehran's habit of detaining U.S. citizens and accusing them of being spies. The latest case involves a Princeton graduate student named Xu Ye Wang. He was sentenced just yesterday to 10 years in an Iranian prison for spying. Wang was doing research in Iran for his dissertation when he was arrested last year. Stephen Kotkin is Wang's advisor at Princeton.
It's very important to understand that Wang is a bona fide PhD student doing regular dissertation research. Nothing he did is different from what any researcher would do. None of us expected this to happen, and it has been gut-wrenching. Words fail to describe what he's going through and his family.
The Mizan News Agency, which is the mouthpiece for Iran's judiciary, said Wang was gathering confidential articles with the intention of delivering them to the State Department and Western academic institutions. Can you tell us what that means?
Yeah, I cannot explain the behavior or the internal workings of Iran's judiciary. What I can tell you is that researchers make contacts, connections, they develop a network with institutions and scholars who support their research and who research themselves related subjects. This is usually considered an achievement. So if you were to contact another university or a British institution that studied Iran and you made contacts there and they helped you make some contacts inside Iran to further your research, as I said, this would all be considered normal and in many cases an achievement. So this is what he has done. As far as the confidentiality of the documents go, he had an Iranian-issued visa. He had Iran permission to work in these places. And as all researchers do, you run out of time. Documents are infinite and time is finite. So you either photocopy or you scan documents. The documents that he scanned or photocopied relate to late 19th, early 20th century history.
He was in Iran, though, and I'm just wondering whether you or anybody at Princeton warned him that, you know, going to Iran and doing this kind of research, it entails a certain amount of risk.
He's been to Uzbekistan. He spent a number of years in Afghanistan. He was a Pashto language translator for the International Red Cross. We understand, as he understood, that these places present many challenges, including political challenges.
Was there a warning or not?
We discuss issues of safety, security, and behavior in all the places that we send our graduate students.
I'm just would like you to tell us, how are you as an advisor able to know everything about your students? I mean, isn't it possible that Wang had a different agenda from the one you know about?
I've known Wang for 4 years. I've seen him on a weekly, sometimes a daily basis during that time. I have no doubt whatsoever that he is a bona fide researcher, a graduate student. That's the purpose he went to Iran for, and that's all he did in Iran.
Stephen Kotkin is a history professor at Princeton University. He's also the advisor of Shuye Wang, who was just sentenced to 10 years in an Iranian prison for spying. Professor Kotkin, thank you very much for being with us, and good luck.
Thank you.
You don't hear much about the war in Ukraine these days, a war that's already cost thousands of lives and displaced millions of people. But the conflict in eastern Ukraine continues between government forces and Russian-backed separatists. And despite a ceasefire currently in place in the region, it breaks down on a regular basis. Our BBC colleague Fergal Keen recently visited the front lines.
We're at the furthest point forward now in the Ukrainian positions, and these trenches are just between 40 and 50 yards from the Russian-backed forces on the other side, just over a wall here. That's why nobody speaks loudly in this place. And you can get a sense of how precarious it is by looking at the sniper who's positioned here. And he's scanning, he's watching for any movement on the other side that could threaten the men who are digging these trenches. What does all this tell you? It tells you it's about permanence, that this war has ground into a stalemate. And that means untold suffering, particularly for the civilian population.
The Ukrainians detonate an unexploded shell. The force of the blast sends shrapnel, stones, dust flying into the air. Imagine this force landing amid a group of people standing in their summer garden. 7-year-old Zhenya Aslanov is an orphan of the war. Her mother Elena was among the people killed when a shell landed in the family's garden near Avdiivka last May. It landed on the roof, she says. And then the child turns inwards, becomes silent. She was the one who first discovered her mother's mutilated body. Her grandmother, Tamara Churakova, is laying flowers where her daughter was killed.
The kids thought a balloon had burst. When they ran out, she saw her mother lying here. Then they ran out from the courtyard onto the street, screaming.
Close to the front line, aid worker Olga Yudina is visiting an elderly woman whose flat was hit by shellfire at the start of the war. There are new windows, but the interior is still smoke-blackened, desolate. Photographs from the 1940s and 50s are bundled on top of what little furniture 88-year-old Anna Vasilyevna saved from the blaze. I'm praying to God to take me, she says. Her memory stretches back through previous ages of famine and war in Ukraine.
It's worse than the Second World War, because no one pays attention. Soon it'll be 3 years since it happened, and I was 85 then.
The visit from the aid worker, Olga, breaks the loneliness of an old woman whose only living relative is a son in Russia. To the younger woman, this flat, this lost old woman, symbolized the plight of the people of Ukraine's front line.
I feel we're left alone with the problem. Nobody cares. Not our own government, nor the international community. Not about our kids, our youth, or our old people. We are trying to have an ordinary life, to go to work or to school under fire. We are just trying to adapt our life to this situation.
A civilian caught up in eastern Ukraine's ongoing war, ending that report by the BBC's Fergal Keen. Coming up, the animals aboard National Geographic's photo ark. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We don't have pictures on the radio, but we can listen to wildlife photographer Joel Sartori at work trying to get a close-up of a white-crowned hornbill, a bird with a big beak.
I just don't want to be blinded. God dang it. This is like a $6,000 camera. Doesn't he know that?
Hey.
Ow.
That was part of Sartori's ambitious plan to photograph some of the world's rarest species before they disappear. After years working as a National Geographic photographer, Sartori says he was motivated to build this so-called photo ark after his wife got sick. He spent a year at home with her while she got treatment for breast cancer.
She's good now. She's made it. It's been 12 years. But during that year at home, I had a chance to stop and think about my life and what to do. And these magazine stories kind of came and went in a month. And I thought, what can I do that would stick? What can I do right this moment to try to get people to pay attention to the extinction crisis that's coming? And this is my best solution as a photojournalist, you know, doing portraits of animals where you can look them in the eye in an undistracted way, lit well, beautifully, that might work.
And Sartori went on to embark on that quest to capture those portraits. And that's the focus of a 3-part TV series starting on PBS tonight. Film crews have been following him around for about a year, but Sartori's been building his photo arc for much longer.
I've been at this 11 years. We've photographed 6,500 species, all on black and white backgrounds, all using studio lighting. And now we figure we're about halfway done. The world has between 12 and 13,000 species in human care around the world.
And this really is. It's like you can travel around with essentially a photo studio. This is portrait photography of animals.
It is. And the reason we do it this way is we want to get real light on these animals, real clean white light through my flash system. And beyond that, it's a great equalizer. A mouse is every bit as impressive and large as an elephant, and a tiger beetle counts as much as a tiger in these things. And also, it provides a way to see these animals in an undistracted fashion. A lot of these critters live in muddy water or in soil or up high in the trees, and so we're able to look these animals directly in the eye and see that there's great intelligence there and that they're worth it. They have a basic right to exist. And since we're on track to lose half of all species by 2100, I just think that if we doom half of everything else to extinction and expect humans to be just fine, it's not going to work that way. We have to have bees and butterflies to pollinate the fruits and vegetables. We have to have intact rainforests to regulate the amount of rainfall we get around the planet in the areas where we know how to grow crops. So there's a lot at stake here.
So I've pulled up on my computer screen here in the studio a few examples of some of the pictures you've taken. The first is an endangered lemur. It's actually an endangered Vondersdeckens siphaca, to be precise.
Right.
I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Right.
He's almost
right.
Posing like in a kind of yoga spinal twist, and his face is a little concerned maybe about you,
yeah.
I'm guessing. Is this a guy or a girl, and what's the backstory to this photo?
I think this is a male, and we'd traveled for this WGBH show that's airing tonight on PBS. We'd traveled all over the world for a year, and this is one of just three in captivity globally at the northern tip of Madagascar. And so in this case, he was actually put inside this big soft cloth shooting tent for us. And all he sees is a small front of my lens, and the shoot just takes a couple minutes. But I'm sure he probably thought he was being abducted by the mothership or something like that.
No. So we should clarify here, National Geographic's photo arc. I mean, all these animals were in zoos or in captivity, and that allowed you to get up close with all this kind of studio gear, right?
Oh, absolutely. It'd be very hard to convince a tiger to come out of the woods in the wild in India and lay down on my black background and be lit for a portrait. So yeah, these are all animals that are in human care around the world.
Here's another picture I'm looking at. It's a gorilla, a cross river gorilla, the only one of its species I read in captivity.
It
really does look like the pose of this animal is intentional. He or she, they've got this coy look in their eye, and it goes right into the camera. Tell me about this shoot.
That's Nyango. She was the only cross-river gorilla in human care in the world, and that was at Limbe Wildlife Center in Cameroon. She has since passed away from old age. There's very few of them in the wild, just a few hundred, and none others that we can see up close. In fact, researchers that work on these animals for years in the forest, they don't get to see them.
So do you get the sense that these animals, they feel like they're being photographed as humans, and do they respond? I mean, it's hard not to get anthropomorphic about all this.
Well, I don't think there's that big a difference between us and them. People want to forget that we're animals too. We're mammals. I mean, and we have to have a healthy planet just like they do to survive. For some reason, we want to put animals in a different category. So if they're anthropomorphic, that's great. That's intentional. We want people to know that there's great intelligence here and there's thoughtfulness. These animals are playful and malicious, and they get sad and they get joyous. And, you know, they're just a lot like us.
So here's your picture of a northern white rhino, one of the last five of its kind left on Earth when you photographed it. And since you took her picture, she's also died. Now there are only three left in the whole world.
Yes.
How does that feel?
People ask me all the time if I get depressed. I don't get depressed. I get mad, and I get inspired to want to use their stories and really get the world to try to pay attention. Each animal that goes away forever through extinction is an opportunity to teach and to try to pry us away from what we're just totally obsessed with, which does not make the world a better place, like current politics or the price of the pump. We just need to talk about the future of life on Earth a little bit. And that's really what the photo arc's about, is to just get people to start thinking about the environment, the world we live in.
And that white-crowned hornbill we heard earlier, did you send him a bill for the lens?
No. You know, I was asking for it, wasn't I? He didn't break anything. It sounds like it, and he was trying.
It did sound like it.
He was the boss. He won that day, and that's just fine. I can't win every time. We did get a couple pictures of him, though, and so he's in the photo arc, and he's a very rare bird.
So you spent 15 years shooting photos of animals out in the wild before starting on these studio-style portraits in zoos and animal reserves. What is the most scared you've ever been at this work? Because you've exposed yourself to a few risks.
I remember day three of a story I was doing on grizzly bears. I got charged by a female grizzly with cubs, and that stunk. But, you know, it's ignorance that gets you in those positions. You really shouldn't have animals charging you. What gets you are the little things, diseases. I ended up getting leishmaniasis, which is a flesh-eating parasite from the Bolivian rainforest. Oh, I got exposed to the Marburg virus, like Ebola, but kills you quicker.
Cousin.
Hemorrhagic fever. Yeah. So I was in quarantine in a spare bedroom in my house for 3 weeks. I remember the doctor saying, well, take your temperature a couple times a day. If you start to spike a fever, drive yourself to the hospital. We'll clear the halls and we'll have a negative air pressure room for you to go in. And there's a 50-50 chance you'll make it.
Oh my gosh.
And you'll be really famous. And I said, well, I don't really want to be famous. I can't shoot anymore if I'm dead. I remember breaking open a bottle of champagne at the end of it and just being very happy that nothing happened. I did not get it. So,
yeah. So it's a pretty remarkable thing you're doing, Joel. But can you prevent extinction with pictures?
Well, I think it's worth a shot. We're pretty confident that we will save some species simply because people don't know they exist and they don't know what the needs are. And I have a lot of faith in humanity to rise to the occasion. So that's really the goal of the photo arc, is to get people to care about the future of life on Earth. And I hope it's just not a record of what we squandered.
National Geographic's Joel Sartori, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Joel's exceptional photos are featured in Rare, Creatures of the Photo Arc, a three-part series that starts tonight on PBS. I'm Marco Werman. When it comes to the public enemies of Chinese internet censors, Winnie the Pooh seems to be number one right now.
Because of the way Winnie the Pooh looks, his actual shape. A lot of people have compared the shape of Winnie the Pooh to Xi Jinping.
Beijing's problem with a famous stuffed bear. That story's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. It's good to have you back. We're launching a new series today. It's called 50 States. And here's the team behind the series, Alex Newman, Jason Margolis, and Andrea Crossan. And Andrea, you're the producer behind this project. What is the plan?
So we are calling this project 50 States, America's Place in a Shrinking World. And what we will literally be doing is stories from 50 states of the Union. We're looking at large urban areas. We're also going to be going to small towns that you need to zoom into on your Google map to find.
And why now?
I wanted to create a series where listeners could be a part of it. I feel like quite often it's a one-way conversation. We tell people what's going on and we hope that they learn something from it or they enjoy it. What I wanted to do with 50 States is have people tell us what is happening where they are. And so we can maybe have a national conversation about it. Things like trade, globalization, immigration, you name it, we are on it. And when I say we, I specifically mean reporter Jason Margolis, who I am sending out on the road, and he may never see his wife and kids again.
Yeah, it's just part of the job, isn't it, Jason? So where have you been?
So Andrea said that we're going to involve a lot of station reporters so we can incorporate people who are actually in these states. So I'm going to be at home with my wife and kids, but I have been to a few states already, and we'll go to a few more.
All right. So where have you been so far, Jason?
So I've been in North Dakota, Iowa, Maine, Ohio. Notice any theme here? I'm in the
northern part,
yes,
of the country.
I'm in the northern. I'm not stupid. It's summertime. It's too hot down south for me.
And what's been the thing that stood out for you?
Well, I think each of these communities, and I've been to smaller communities that have kind of been left behind by globalization, if you will. And there's this push-pull of people who are looking back, not trying to recreate the past exactly as it was, but trying to tap into that magic again, these once prosperous places. And then there are people saying, we need to move on. We need to reinvent ourselves. And it's a very, very tricky, difficult thing to do.
So listeners, on top of the possibility that the 50 States team will come to your town, you can also learn some really cool stuff about where you actually live. And Alex Newman, you've come up with some digital wizardry here as part of the 50 States team, an online tool. Tell us how this thing works.
Well, first I need you to choose a county, Marco.
Okay, I'm going to say Orange County, a place I used to live in North Carolina, because there are a lot of Orange counties.
There are a lot of Orange counties. Well, so the idea is that we can look up any county in the United States here. And so if we look at what happened in Orange County, we're trying to show change in America. And so the top part of this graphic shows you simple median household income, but mm-hmm. we're comparing that county against the state it's from and the United States itself. So you can see that in Orange County, North Carolina, between 1989 and 2015, there was a large increase in median income, 10%, but overall income fell 1.2% in North Carolina. So if we're going to talk about Orange County, North Carolina in the context of the state, things look like they're doing okay.
Yeah. Well, I mean, talk about America's place in a shrinking world. If you look at manufacturing, down.
Right. If you go further down, you can take a look at how certain industries have grown or changed over that same period of time. And here, there's a 15% drop in manufacturing in North Carolina overall. I mean, that's a long period of time, and America has changed a lot. And so that's how this tool works.
Alex, remind us where we can actually see and use this online tool.
This will be up on PRI.org. The other thing that's on the same webpage on PRI is a form where if you have a story idea and you want us to come visit your state and your town, you can write us and we will put it on our list.
Wow, fantastic. All right. Thank you all very much. And now, Jason's first story from 50 States, this one from Newton, Iowa.
About a decade ago, 2,000 people were building washers and dryers at the old Maytag manufacturing facility in Newton. The cavernous building is the size of 7 Walmarts. I walk around with Jim Scuddy, a burly man who stands 6'8".
Did you work here?
Yes.
What did you do for Maytag?
I was a machine repairman.
And you worked in this building?
Yes.
After 21 years with Maytag, Scuddy lost his job in 2006 when Whirlpool bought Maytag and shifted manufacturing to other states and Mexico.
How was that for you?
Just moved on, you know. Got to do what you got to do.
Today, a handful of tenants rent warehouse space here, and Scuddy manages the property. I ask him if it's strange to be back working in the old Maytag factory.
It used to bother me at first, but anymore, you know. Pretty good. Well, it'll bother me August 17th because that's when I would have had my 30 years in.
So why will it bother you on August 17th?
Because that's when I could have retired. And Maytag had you had your full medical benefits and a nice pension when you retired with 30 years in.
When do you think you'll retire now?
Probably never.
Now, at this point, you might be thinking, okay, here's another profile of a dying manufacturing city and the people that got left behind. Wrong. Not Newton, Iowa.
The unemployment rate in 2009 was 9.9%, and today it's a 3.5%.
That's Frank Liebel, executive director of the Newton Development Corporation. It's his job to attract new businesses to the area. Since Maytag left, community leaders have helped attract a lot of new employers with a simple pitch. We're ready to work.
You know, when you lose that many people out of a community, all of a sudden companies say, wow, I'm going to come to Newton, Iowa because they got the infrastructure, they got the buildings, and they got the workforce.
But a lot of American cities could make that pitch. What's different about Newton? For one thing, the population has held stable. The buildings and streets are clean and well-maintained. So how did it get back on its feet when so many other small manufacturing cities throughout the Midwest hit hard times and shriveled up? An Arizona-based company that makes windmill blades, TPI Composites, chose to open a factory in Newton. Amy Levitt shows me around.
The blades are made in two halves.
The blades stretch 187 feet long. TPI pumps out 27 of them a week here. Levitt says TPI was attracted by engaged local leaders and the incentives they offered.
When TPI was looking to expand in the Midwest, Newton gave some tax incentives, some abatements for...
Since coming to Newton a decade ago, TPI has grown from a handful of workers to more than 1,100. Mindy Pollock cuts fiberglass for the windmill blades. We spoke away from the factory floor. She'd been at Maytag for 22 years when she was let go.
I've seen grown men crying that day.
She was out of work for 8 months and took advantage of some job retraining for laid-off workers.
I actually took a computer class, just the basic computer class.
Did that help you or no?
Yes. Mm-hmm. The older you get, the less you know about that kind of the technology, and so it did help me.
She now uses a computer every day at her new job. Now, at this point, you may be thinking, I see. So this is a story about a manufacturing city that's figured things out. Not exactly that either. Economist Dave Swenson at Iowa State University says Newton has indeed stopped its decline, but it hasn't fully recovered. Jobs building windmill blades are great, and TPIS helped Newton's job base tremendously, but those jobs don't pay as well. In 2001, the going rate for manufacturing work in Newton was 37% above Iowa's state average.
In 2015, it was about 20% below the state average. And so the standard of living for the workforce has gone down measurably.
And that job retraining program that helped Mindy Pollock find work building windmill blades? Classes aren't for everyone. When Jim Scuddy was laid off, he and many others said, no thanks.
I had enough of school when I was in it.
It's hard to blame Scuddy for not wanting to go back. Economist Dave Swenson says more education and learning new trades are good things.
But thinking you can just come on in and then say, okay, we're going to train you to be this as opposed to that, there are so many failures. And by the time somebody does get trained in something, oftentimes it's already too late. That sector isn't hiring anymore. We're really, really bad at figuring out what the next thing is.
There's also the problem of too much hope that life will somehow go back to normal. Many union manufacturing jobs of the 20th century required little education, but offered good pay and benefits. Swenson says too many of these Midwestern cities and politicians are trying to recreate that past.
Their mindset is we just need to replace these jobs with manufacturing, make America great again, reemploy workers in the manufacturing sector. But it's not as simple as that.
Still, Donald Trump's message caught on like wildfire around Newton. Barack Obama won this area in 2008 and 2012. Trump demolished Hillary Clinton here last November. I asked Swenson and his colleague, economist Liesl Ethington, if President Trump or any president can bring back manufacturing jobs to the heartland.
No, and I think about the years that we've seen individual communities trying to do it. We've seen states trying to do it. So it's not like nobody has thought of it before. When you think about 20, 30, 40 years of economic development strategies, it's the same thing. It's just got new words attached to it.
Still, the economists at Iowa State say that doesn't mean you just throw your hands up in the air and give up. They say industrial cities need to look forward, not back, and diversify their economies. Amanda Price with the Newton Chamber of Commerce says her city has embraced that message.
We're trying to stay ahead of the game so that things like Maytag don't happen again. I hate to say it, but the city put all their eggs in one basket for so many years.
But why wouldn't they do that? Life was good in Newton for a long, long time. And Maytag was a good corporate citizen. It paid for things like community parks, the local aquatic center, and the auditorium. A lot of people in Newton remain bitter that Maytag left that all behind. Price and I walked around Newton's downtown square, coffee shops, stores, and restaurants. No boarded up windows. It's not Paris, but it's not bad. Price wants her city to move past Maytag emotionally. She says when the company left, it was like somebody died.
It was. It literally was. We've actually talked about having a major community event where we actually have a funeral and we bury Maytag for good.
For The World, Jason Margolis, Newton, Iowa.
Have you thought it through? What would you bury?
I'm not entirely sure.
An entire Maytag washer. Yeah. We would bury it in the ground.
People could bring their Maytag stuff if they still have something and just let it go.
That was the first of our stories in our new series, 50 States, America's Place in a Shrinking World. Thanks to the good people of Newton, Iowa, for welcoming us and providing our first stop on this journey. If you want to be a part of our series, go to PRI.org to tell us more about your story and your state. Or just tweet us using the hashtag 50 States. That's 50 States. It's a scene worthy of a classic movie heist, a nighttime break-in, criminals working in the shadows. And the haul? Not gold, not diamonds. 2 award-winning blocks of cheddar cheese. This happened for real, not in Wisconsin or Vermont, but in southern England. The World's Leo Hornack is on the case.
Last Saturday, Richard Clothier of White Farms was a proud man.
His traditional vintage cheddar had won first prize at the prestigious Yeovil Farm Show in rural Somerset. Imagine a sort of Olympics of old school English country life. As well as best cheddar, there are also awards for best dog, best blacksmith, and best vintage tractor. It's quite simply no exaggeration at all to say that this is probably one of the most important cheddar competitions in the world. Richard's family have been making cheddar for a long time now.
My grandmother was the first one to write the recipe down, and so she would have been really proud of us winning awards like this. And we still make this vintage cheddar to my family's 100-year-old family recipe.
But that's where things started to curdle. Rich left his precious prize-winning cheeses at the judging tent overnight, ready to display the next day. You can guess what happened next. Not a trace left. Even the award certificates had been taken. The question is, how did the thieves make off with their hoard of creamy, mild, yet slightly nutty loot? They're not easy to carry.
There's two big blocks and they're quite heavy. Each one weighs about the same as a large bag of cement, so it's not the sort of thing you could just slip into your handbag or tuck up your jumper.
As to who was responsible, Richard and the team at White are keeping an open mind. Cheddar's got popular recently, and White's now sells to 160 countries around the world. Could this be an international crime hit, part of the global dairy mafia? Or possibly, he admits, just some hungry locals heading home from the pub. Either way, the missing cheeses now have a bounty on their head, around $650 total. No questions asked, returned intact. Richard just wants them home.
You know, at the end of the day, we just want to see the cheese back so that I can, you know, share the certificates with the team here. Incredibly proud of White Farms to have won these fantastic prizes.
For the world, I'm Leo Hornack.
A quick look ahead now at some stories we're working on for later this week. I'll be speaking with Lale Kadivi. She's the author of a new novel called A Good Country. It's all about trying to tear down barriers.
People will individually put up walls. They will put up walls around themselves and around their faith groups or around their geographical groups or around their class or around their ethnicities, and they will judge from behind those walls because we have not yet figured out a way to truly merge with one another peacefully and without, you know, the hesitations of racism and prejudice and judgment. Those are present still. And I think that rather than microaggressions, they just happen to be the reality of us all trying to be in the same place at the same time.
The barriers in Kadivi's novel go up within a group of teenage surf bums. More of our conversation in the days ahead. Plus, the Trump administration has declared this Made in America Week. But in many places in the U.S., stuff doesn't get made or done without foreign workers.
For the most part, when we come, we work very hard because that's what we're here to do. We're here to work. We don't hang around. We don't sit around. We just work.
The Chinese government has a long track record of silencing its online critics. Its latest target, though, might surprise you.
Winnie the Pooh, Winnie the Pooh, tubby little tubby all stuffed with fluff.
Oh, bother. The fluffy fictional bear Winnie the Pooh is back on the Chinese government's blacklist.
It's been censored in China for the last 2 years, on and off.
That's Carrie Allen, my colleague at the BBC. She monitors Chinese media.
What's new this time is that the actual word Winnie is being censored on Chinese social media. So if anyone types in Winnie, a lot of their posts are being removed. It might just be a single post that just says Winnie and they're being taken offline.
So just what is it about Pooh Bear that the Chinese government finds so offensive?
Because of the way Winnie the Pooh looks, his actual shape, a lot of people have compared the shape of Winnie the Pooh to Xi Jinping.
That'd be Chinese President Xi Jinping. Parody images comparing Xi and Pooh had been going viral in China. For example, there's a picture of the Chinese president at a military parade peering through the roof of his limousine. Social media users took that image and paired it with a Pooh toy riding in a tiny convertible. And there was a photo of Xi strolling with President Obama a while back. The internet took that and changed it to Pooh strolling with Tigger. Pooh is slouching, Tigger stands tall and confident. Not terribly flattering. But this is about more than just the image of Pooh and any insulting comparison with President Xi. The word bear itself is considered an insult by many Chinese. the BBC's Carrie Allen again.
So bear has connotations of being unruly. There's a term in China, a bear child, which is almost like a feral child. So if your child is quite spoilt, they do whatever they want, then they're thought of as a bear child. So the idea that Xi Jinping is like a bear gives the idea that he's a bit rogue. He does what he wants. The people don't have a say.
So right now, Winnie the Pooh may be a sort of fictional persona non grata on Chinese social media. But Allen says that doesn't mean Pooh is out of sight, out of mind.
It's very well known in China, especially since Shanghai brought Disneyland to China in the mainland for the first time. You can widely buy merchandise online, and the films made out of the cartoon are available for people to watch.
But for now, those Pooh and Xi parodies are offline in China. You can see them, though, at PRI.org. And finally today...
Could you be Aladdin? Seriously, can someone just be Aladdin already? Anybody? Aladdin? Magic carpet ride?
Disney anyone? Can't because find Aladdin. They can't find someone to play the role, that is. Last week, we heard the rumor that Disney was struggling to find someone of Middle Eastern or Indian descent who can act, sing, and dance. Some say that would be an example of Hollywood's laziness when it comes to diversity in casting. I mean, Bollywood? Hello. And interestingly, the Aladdin debate comes at a time when one of Hollywood's most vocal critics on this point has passed away. Jack Shaheen was a Lebanese-American who had a hard time with the industry's representations of Arabs and Middle Easterners on the silver screen. Here's the world's Shirin Jafari with more.
Update. Disney has found Aladdin. Mina Masood, a Canadian Egyptian, will play the character in the new Aladdin adaptation. Still, some fans aren't happy about the actress who's going to play Jasmine. She's not Arab. Her mother is of Indian descent, and her father is British. Anyone who's been paying the tiniest bit of attention to Hollywood knows that casting and portraying Arabs hasn't been the industry's strong suit. This is exactly the kind of beef that Jack Shaheen had with Hollywood.
All aspects of our culture project the Arab as villain. That is a given.
Shaheen, a Lebanese-American academic, died last week at the age of 81. He spent decades arguing against the stereotypes of Arabs on screen. This is Shaheen in a 2006 documentary based on his book, Real Bad Arabs, How Hollywood Vilifies a People. Real is spelled R-E-E-L.
Whether one lives in Paducah, Kentucky or Wood River, Illinois, we know basically the same thing.
The Arabs, Shaheen said, are often the ones who set off the bombs, steal, trick the innocent white characters. If there's an American movie with a Middle Eastern or Arab character, chances are Shaheen saw it. Jack Chen teaches at New York University and knew Shaheen well.
You would think that after looking at all these films that he would be a bitter person. I probably would be, you know, after looking at these horrible images of both men and women, very stereotyped, very caricatured. And he was actually just a really decent, gentle guy.
Shaheen first got interested in Hollywood's portrayal of Arabs by accident. One Saturday morning in 1974, his two kids were watching cartoons.
His children came to him and said, "Daddy, Daddy, you know, I saw a bad Arab on TV." And he began paying attention to those kinds of representations.
When Shaheen first started talking about the negative ways Arabs are portrayed in movies, he said Hollywood simply ignored him.
They accused him of being too sensitive. These are just foils. We don't really mean it.
But he persisted. As his kids watched cartoons like Aladdin, he watched along with them.
Oh, I come from a land, from a faraway place, where the caravan camels roam. Where they cut off your ear if they don't like your face. It's barbaric, but hey, it's home.
Where they cut off your ear if they don't like your face. It's barbaric, but hey, it's home.
Jack Shaheen again in his documentary Real Bad Arabs.
Now how could a producer with a modicum of intelligence, just a modicum of sensitivity, let a song such as that open the film?
Shaheen put his foot down on this one.
In some ways, his major victory was over the lyrics for Disney's Aladdin. Disney begrudgingly took out some lyrics that were just outrageously offensive.
Disney changed the lyrics when it released the film on video. Shaheen wasn't trying to make all depictions of Arabs and Muslims rosy. He just wanted them to be real.
Once we begin to humanize Arabs and Muslims, to project them as we project other people, no better, no worse, then the stereotype gradually diminishes.
Shaheen knew this would take time, and so he set up a scholarship for Arab American college students to study media. One of the recipients is Phoebe Leila Barghouti.
Reading his work, even just like as a young college student, it's like when somebody makes you realize that you're not crazy. That like when kids made fun of you, it wasn't nice, you know, like you're not being overly sensitive.
Barghouti is saddened by Shaheen's death, yet she's hopeful too.
I know that there are so many different types of people that are feeling marginalized now and feeling attacked. And the most important thing with any of these community members who speak out for those kind of civil rights is that, you know you have an ally.
For many, that's who Jack Shaheen was, an ally. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
I can show you the world, shining, shining.
Hey, it's what we try to do every day here, show you the world. And that'll do it for us from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you all tomorrow.
I can open your eyes, take you wonder by wonder, over, sideways, and under, on a magic carpet ride, a whole new world, a new fantastic point of view, no one to tell.
PRI, Public Radio International.